Well, now, if the 20th century was the century of the car, it looks likely that the 21st may be that of rail once again. Railways are being planned and built all over the world at an enormous rate, and not just in big cities either. Here at home, for instance, every state has priority rail projects. Brisbane's Cross River Rail and the Melbourne Metro are just two that come to mind. But it's how to get them funded. That's the issue. There's a sense, of course, that the road still rules when it comes to transport and infrastructure spending. And the opposition leader, Tony Abbott, is on the record as saying that the Commonwealth should only fund roads. To quote him, "We have no history of funding urban rail, and I think it's important we stick to our knitting. And the Commonwealth's knitting, when it comes to funding infrastructure, is roads." Well, for a sense of the ongoing debate around transport policy, which of course did enter the budget this week and might well enter the election campaign, we'll see, I'd like to welcome now Peter Newman, Professor of Sustainability at Curtin University in Perth. Peter's also a board member of Infrastructure Australia and the lead author for Transport on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. I should mention that Peter is a rail enthusiast, if I can put it like that. He's credited with revitalising Perth's rail system. So Peter Newman, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Good morning.
In a recent piece for the Conversation website, you background the explosion in rail developments around the world. So tell us about urban rail especially and the remarkable growth in China and India, for instance.
Yeah, it is mind-blowing to see what's happening there. 82 Chinese cities building metros, like Shanghai, which built a metro in 10 years, which is now the biggest in the world and carrying 8 million people a day. In India, 16 cities building metros, you know, very expensive project, but they dramatically transform their cities, and that's what they're after, because they went with the car to some extent, and they just filled their cities so quickly.
And it's not just big cities that are investing in light rail, is it?
No, they're heavy rail projects, the metros, but light rail is also taking off, particularly in smaller cities that many people thought in the past were too small. And the too small category is diminishing. It's getting smaller and smaller. So we've got 7 cities in Australia proposing light rail, small cities like Cairns and Bendigo and Hobart, even Canberra. And many of them, I think, are very determined to get them. That is part of a global movement, 100 cities in the US building light rail.
And we're talking about what, cities of less than about 150,000, I read.
Yeah, 150,000. There's now several hundred cities that have got light rail on their plans that are less than 150,000. Now, that was unheard of until recently.
Yeah, we actually got, after me speaking to Fran Kelly about this, we got an email from one of our listeners about the plans in Hobart. She represents a Northern Suburbs light rail group called the Hobart Northern Suburbs Railway. But she says there's talk about this, but the next step, evaluation and funding, is just not taken. One of the most interesting things about this is that 90% of the land needed is presently held by the government, she writes, in railway for freight. Whereas if it was used for passenger transport, it would mean that people in the low SES area would not take over 1 hour to get to the city by bus, and their ability to get to colleges, years 11 and 12, would be easier, etc. So sort of social, environmental and transport benefits. Is that a typical story?
It is very typical, and the discovery that rail helps you with land development and you could actually tap into that land development as a way of funding it is the new insight. Many American cities building light rail that way. It's called value capture, and it is a way of taking the fact that land value will go up, and then the taxes that are created from that, the extra money that goes to government coffers, can be hypothecated and put back into the financing process.
So you now mean that houses and suburbs adjacent to the rail, we can be pretty sure their values go up, and this can be notionally included in the extra rates they'll pay? That's what you mean?
In fact, it can be much more scientific. We've done a study that shows the value of land goes up 18% on traditional railways in Perth, like the Fremantle Line, for residential, and 40% for commercial. And in the new Southern Rail, that where it goes down the middle of a freeway, it was not a good thing to live or work near the freeway because of the noise and traffic. But now the railway goes down the middle of it, the value of land near stations has gone up 42% in just a few years. So it is a dramatic increase. You can tap it. And we are working with the Treasury Corporation over here to see how we can get a mechanism that will enable us to build our light rail project, which is a substantial one. But Hobart could do it very easily with the land that's available along there, and Canberra fully committed to doing that as a way ahead as well.
What would it cost in theory in Hobart, say?
Well, light rail tends to be somewhere between 20 and 30 million per kilometre to build, and the value of land around it within just the walking distance around those stations generally can pay 100% of that value. Now, you don't always have the opportunity to tap that, so government money usually goes into it. But we are now in a situation where there is such a market for rail, we should be calling for expressions of interest from the private sector to build, own, operate and do the land development around stations, and they would compete as to how they would best do that. It really should be something that government now hands over in a way where they guide it, but which can tap into the new private sector opportunities.
Well, in fact, Alan Davies, writing, who's a transport and town planning consultant and blogs as The Urbanist, he was writing in Crikey suggesting that there's these availability payments that, in effect, the government provides, or I think already provides, to investors, where it minimises government borrowings, but it suggests also minimises the risk borne by investors. The result is taxpayers pay more, probably much more, than they would if governments borrowed directly. It sounds like you don't agree with that.
No, I don't. I think it's a partnership that's needed. Governments, yeah, they can borrow at lower rates, but if you do it in a partnership, the borrowing is substantially better achieved because of the backing of government. And the government only needs to help with ensuring that the welfare and common good issues are there and regulated, and then enabling a fund to be set up that will tap this value capture process in an ongoing way.
But are you saying, can I just cut it, you know, are you wishing and aspiring to having the private sector really want to step up, or do you know they are? There's a difference.
Look, they're desperate to step up. You see, the Spanish have been doing interesting things, the Italians, the French, these are the ones who've been doing light rail for 20 or 30 years. They know how to make it happen, and they want to be able to contribute in other parts of the world, especially as their worlds are not doing so well economically. So they're lining up to come to places like Australia and assist in this kind of process. The Gold Coast Light Rail was set up originally to do something like this, and they got five consortiums from around the world competing. In the end, they pulled out the land part of it, but they kept on with the consortiums who would build, own and operate it. And it is funded, the operations funded through a Gold Coast Council levy. That's a partnership process that's worked really well. It's being built and the opportunities are there to extend it now. Everyone wants it. What they missed was the opportunity to tap that land value capture because international investors came from all over the world to invest around the stations once they heard that was going in.
Do you think conceivably, final question, Peter, that in a way this whole question of light rail, let's say, as a public transport could become something like an election issue? You know, we have Tony Abbott's comment that rail isn't in the Commonwealth knitting when it comes to funding infrastructure, whereas we had the Treasurer pledging that money for the Melbourne and the Brisbane ventures. Now, do you think people have, you know, does it capture people?
Oh, yeah. Look, it has been the number one issue in the New South Wales election, the Melbourne Victorian election, and now the WA one. The politicians were rather astonished by how much public transport played a role in their elections, but and are struggling to now deliver on some of them. But I think that Tony Abbott has missed the change that's happened. The reality is car use is in free fall. Around the world's developed cities, car use per capita is going down dramatically. People are flocking to public transport, and we don't have enough of it. So it's a genuine big issue. But Tony Abbott has committed something like $30 billion, which surely they don't have, to three huge roads in Melbourne, Brisbane and Sydney, and at the same time saying that Urban Rail's not in the knitting. Well, I think he's missing an opportunity for a private sector, very conservative government-oriented mechanism that could deliver Urban Rail, and it really should be in his knitting.
Peter Newman, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Great to talk to you.
Thank you.
Peter Newman, Professor of Sustainability at Curtin University in Perth, and a board member of Infrastructure Australia.